Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Enterprise Sales Development Podcast, brought to you by Cyence Technologies. We interview outbound leaders at fast-growth businesses to learn their secrets and bring you actionable insights. Thanks for joining us this week.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to Enterprise Sales Development. I'm your host, Eric Quanstrom, the CMO at Cyence. Today's episode... Boy, oh boy, get ready for this one. Power packed. We had Jimmy Chen, and Jimmy's frankly got a ton of experience, especially at the enterprise business development, sales development level for a variety of tech-based companies, some of which you may have heard of. So he's currently the director of sales development over at Envoy. Prior to that, led worldwide sales development at Lattice. Spent time leading worldwide sales development at HackerOne, and was also head of account development, same thing at Waggle. So long kind of story career, if you will, in the sales development space. And one of the interesting conversations that we get into today is he took it upon himself to create a framework. And oh boy, if you're not using this, you should. So it's well worth you tuning in and listening to the rest of our conversation to learn what that framework is, why it's got such a catchy name, and why it's frankly so spot on that it's not even funny. So whether you're leading sales development or learning the craft net new, Jimmy has got a ton of really valuable insights and real world advice to guide you in the right direction. So without further ado, let's get to our conversation. Here's Jimmy Chen. And we're back with Jimmy Chen. Jimmy, it's a real pleasure to have you on the Enterprise Sales Development Podcast, mainly because, as far as I can tell, you're one of the most senior, tenured, experienced SDR leaders anywhere in the United States.
Eric, that's rather generous. I'm not sure if I would say that about myself. I definitely think of myself as a bit of an older dog, so to speak, in this space. There is quite a brain drain, for lack of better words, across sales development leadership. So I guess I'm one of the last holdouts, if you will.
Or you could say the upper 1%, whatever, you know, suits you.
Yeah, I don't know if I'm there yet.
As director of sales development at Envoy, prior to that, being a part of Lattice and HackerOne and running the sales development teams of conspicuous size, I think you've probably learned a thing or two. And that's actually where I'd love to jump into the conversation, as we were talking offline before about the framework that you've developed for sales development, which I think is actually very useful for everyone listening to this podcast.
Sure. And thank you again, Eric, for having me and that the generous introduction. Yeah, I started in sales development in 2017 or so. And the thing that's really kept me in sales development over the last couple of years was just a constant state of change. When I first started, it was Tout App, if anyone listening remembers that. And now we're talking about incorporating AI and the like into our processes, right? But one of the common trends or the thread that connects everything is that when you think about the actual sales development management methodology and how people think about sales development as a whole, it's riddled with a lot of ad hoc advice and the like to do this or that. And oftentimes managers and reps especially are operating without some sort of guiding star, right? A framework of sorts. And what you were alluding to earlier, one of the frameworks that I've given all the folks that I've ever managed and managers I've ever managed was this framework called the MAT framework. It's an acronym, M-A-T, for messaging, activities, targeting, and timeline. And it's something that I've used for individual reps to think about what are those levers across sales development that I can pull to hit my number? And secondly, for managers, it's using that as a diagnostic tool to understand where are those shortcomings and subsequently creating programs, focus areas for the team so that they're able to hopefully hit their number or exceed it across one of these areas.
It's also a useful diagnostic, I think, for pulling into assessing any time an SDR is not hitting their numbers, right? Mm-hmm. Like just going through the checklist and the framework, because there's so many, if you want to call them KPIs or key metrics behind each one of those areas. I'd love to dovetail into where you start, which is messaging. Because I actually think that we don't talk about this enough in sales development.
100%. When you and I talked offline, I shared with you my principles around sales development and how I can provide value for a business. And there's a lot of organizations that talk about doing this. If you were a sales leader or even a marketing leader as you are, you oftentimes you reach out to the sales development leader and you have one question for them. And that one question is always, so what's working? How are you guys and gals booking meetings? And oftentimes that SDR leader has no idea how to respond, right? And what they inevitably end up doing is going to the reps and asking the team ad hoc and asking, so what's resonating? What are you booking? How are you getting these meetings? What's working? What's not? And there isn't really a framework or thought around how to answer that question other than some anecdotal evidence of sorts of, I said this on a call and they said yes, and I guess we're going into this industry now. And then we go back to marketing and sales and we tell them, yeah, this industry is really hot. We should put all of our focus there. And the marketing and sales leaders are like, okay, if that's what they're hearing on the front lines, then I guess maybe we'll take a look into it or we'll throw some spend in against it. But the importance of messaging is something that you hear from all sales leaders, all marketing leaders, because it continues to change. So when I think about messaging, I, as a rep using this framework, would think about, is it resonating across the personas I'm going after, right? What about my message is actually capturing them? What's the format? Is it via email? Is it via the phone? Am I talking about certain pain points that are resonating? What's actually happening? And what are those things within how I think about messaging that could change? And the framework here is really not meant to give you really prescriptive guidance, right? It's not like if this, then that. It's really putting the focus so that you can be introspective about how you think about your messaging, right? And really dissecting that with a really fine knife, for lack of better words, right? It's really going in deep, understanding what's working and not, and then subsequently thinking through what are those systems for capture that can help you either iterate on your messaging or share feedback with your cross-functional peers, partners.
I'm really glad that you explained and provided additional context there, because one of the biggest mistakes that I see in kind of SDR land all the time is thinking of messaging as me as a vendor leading with me and my message, as opposed to the sales development best practice that wise individuals already know. How do I lead with the prospect? How do I forge how do I start a conversation that's interested in them, mm-hmm. that then gets to somewhere in that conversation, somewhere in that email, somewhere in that LinkedIn message, somewhere in that phone call, my core messaging?
Yeah, 100%. And what I would add to that is that the best organizations I've seen have some sort of framework for messaging and guidance around how to craft things that people will react to, hopefully positively. Right. And a lot of that is around this idea of selling to pain, perhaps. Maybe it's building social proof. Maybe it's going through and making sure that it's the right reference organizations, right? Maybe it's not too much detail, et cetera. There's just so much to it, but it's putting this focus on how you think about messaging and examining if you have specific standards or things that you've outlined for reps to actually execute against. Are we doing that?
Right.
And asking yourself those questions and taking the time to think about it, other than being in a position where you think, okay, my messaging doesn't resonate. What do I do? What do? Is you stop, you think about it, you understand why. Is it against the standards that you've outlined? If not, what change needs to be had? And that's the first area of focus. And then I know we're talking about the rep side, but on the managerial side, it's creating programs, processes around how you iterate on your messaging, whether it's something as simple as A/B testing through your sequences, to having folks try out different things on the phone, which all of this is intuitively obvious, but it's building systems around that, getting scientific with it, and of course, actually looking at the results of that to make changes, which people say that they do, but I'm getting the feeling that people don't actually do it or do it in a way that is, you know, almost scientific.
Yeah, I think that's a really big issue, and I'd even love to peel the onion there, because I think that one of the best things about direct response is that you can measure channel by channel. You can measure and break out a lot of different criteria for what you could be testing or different messaging you can use. For instance, email, subject line, right? Like I can test different subject line headers. I can test different email openers, different calls to action, different ways of getting to a value proposition across any of the pain, the proof, the reference. I would even throw in trends or commercial insights or anything along those lines into kind of like the messaging body, so to speak. And then you can look at the results coming back off of that statistically speaking, total number of outreach, total number of responses in a very contained and, dare I even say, objective manner.
Sure. Let me peel the onion another layer for you there when you think about response, right? I think oftentimes people think about getting to a response in and of itself is the success metric, when in fact, it's just the initial trigger, right? That's where it starts.
Yep.
And where I believe, and again, I'm talking on a podcast without any statistics here, but from my anecdotal observation, is that there isn't a playbook for what happens after the response. So if you think about direct response copywriting, a lot of it is about this idea of driving people toward a call to action. Mm-hmm. And I think it's been bastardized over the last couple of years in sales development, where that call to action is just another way of saying book a meeting. And I think it's this discipline from a messaging perspective to say that call to action could be a lot of different things, whether it's, you know, engaging with some sort of content, whether it's doing a specific thing beyond just booking a meeting, because naturally prospects are really tired of hearing that. Not enough value has been displayed, and there's just so much more work that needs to be done nowadays. So then it's thinking through, okay, as you look at your messaging, what are the logical next steps thereafter? So for instance, it could be something as simple as I shot a message that was very specific toward a target persona for a webinar that we just had. And instead of saying, here's a link to the webinar, or here's respond if you want the recording, we go into the webinar and say, hey, as a director of security, when we had blah, 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 and blah, blah, blah on our webinar recently, they talked about this topic. At 3:14 is the 10 minute clip, and you can click here to learn more. And that's not really direct response. It's just telling them to do something, right? However, if you would like some sort of offer that we can give them, let's talk. And then there's a series of things that you do thereafter. So it's a little bit more than just have a meeting with me because I'm a BDR and I want to sell you stuff. Like, it's beyond that. I think there's a really big movement over the last year or so. And I know we're getting into the messaging weeds a little bit too much here, but it's, there's a lot of things where it's asking for curiosity, you know, asking if they're curious, right? And spurring curiosity. It's, you know, getting some sort of yes or no, perhaps, right? Which people have done in the past. All of this is starting to come back, because what it's really saying is that messaging is a means to start some sort of interaction, right? As a driver for that, versus that being the exchange that leads to the ultimate outcome for BDRs. Oftentimes it's a meeting. It's just giving us another chance to start selling versus it being the actual sale,
yes,
so to speak.
Ultimately, you could even break down, and I'd love to get either validation or disapproval on this statement, but you could summarize the SDR role very succinctly by saying your job is just to get the meeting. Like, your job is to get an outcome on the first part of a sales cycle. So getting to a next step is probably the easiest definition, whatever that next step might be, to allude to what you just said, the logical next step. Mm-hmm. But what's interesting to me about that is too many people default to the default there, which is calling a meeting, not even dressing it up, not even spending like an iota in offer science, if you will, around what might be the trigger, the quid pro quo, the way in which the prospect I'm reaching out to sees it not as just your average, ordinary, garden variety, been there, done that type of SDR fronted meeting.
Yep. So I generally agree with what you said there. I think the latter part more so than the former part. I think the role of the BDR, without oversimplifying it, is a little bit more than just getting the meeting. And I think it depends on the organization that you're working with and the like. But I think the earliest in the maturity model of your sales development program will involve a BDR setting a meeting for sure, right? And then the follow on thereafter is, who's that meeting with? Are they doing a qualification call? Are they going further down in the process? Every organization has their own perspective around how far they want their BDRs to go. And naturally that comes with different strategies. But to your point specifically about that exchange, the so-called quid pro quo or the lack thereof, it's really interesting, because when I talk to a lot of, I don't want to throw your peers, marketers, under the bus, but a lot of it. Yeah, sure. Perhaps. No, I actually really like marketers, so I don't think I can ever say that. But it's not just this door opener, door knocker thing where you give them an item or there's some sort of exchange and thus values realized. The greatest gift from a messaging perspective, from a BDR perspective, that you can give a prospect that actually gives them value is context, right? Yeah. It's relevance. And that's really what it's all about. There was, oh gosh, well, we're spending a lot of time on this, but I'm really enjoying it. So there's this one thing here where, who said this, but there's this idea of putting an idea on in someone else's mind, right? So yep. If I say to you right now, Eric, yellow Ferrari, what are you thinking of?
Yellow Ferrari.
Why are you thinking about that?
Because you prompted me.
Because I prompted you, right? So a lot of that is, how do you get their attention and capture their mind space and put it to talk about the very narrow thing that you want to talk about? When you and I last talked, and I was talking about BDRs that we hired at HackerOne about two companies ago. And it's a really technical sale, right? It's about getting hackers to try to hack different companies on the company's behalf so that they're able to find different bugs and vulnerabilities. And we wanted to hire a lot of BDRs that could have this level of conversation. So we made the mistake of hiring super technical folks that were just could understand the stuff, but wasn't necessarily the best salesy. They weren't really into sales, right? They thought they were. And that didn't really work out. And what we've come to realize is that if you train a BDR to have a very specific conversation at a high level, they'll know when they're talking to a person whether or not they're actually talking about the thing that they're supposed to, the relevancy part, right? And if they're hearing anything that they have no idea what the heck is going on, which going after information security officers oftentimes happen, they'll know to steer it back, right? And if you think about what we train them on, it's just relevant context, right? Relevant context. Anything that's not relevant, they don't have the context for, and thus they will not have that conversation most of the time, which brings us all back to this idea of messaging, right? It's like, how do you actually get people to respond to you? What does that response look like? What are the actions that you'll do thereafter? And do you have a system or process for it? And how do you think about your messaging beyond what is my response rate? How many clicks did I get on an email? Truly, as a BDR, as an IC, what are you going to do with that information? What does a 45% click rate mean versus a 52% click rate? Yeah, there's 5% difference there, right? Just about. But what does that really mean? And how do you know if your messaging is working or not? And part of that is the steps that you take thereafter, figuring out if the context has been clearly established.
Yeah, I love that. And that's a really good example. And it largely gets to one of my favorite ways to think about sales development. I don't know if you've read the book Thinking in Bets by Annie Duke, but I love the overall thesis of the book, which is essentially what really good card players do. She was the World Series of Poker champion, which is like her background on why thinking in bets in the first place.
Yeah.
But it's really an introduction into probabilistic thinking. And so if you think about like an SDR's job, probabilities are your biggest kind of like barriers, if you will. Mm-hmm. Day in, day out, all the activities you do, all the contacts you reach out to, every message you send, all of it comes back to what is the most probabilistic outcome from any of where I spend my time, and how do I forever improve those odds?
Yep. So it's so funny that you bring up this book, because someone else was talking to me about this recently. And it might've been you, might've been someone else, but about outcome-based thinking.
Yeah.
And how do you orient the behaviors to drive toward that specific outcome, and how we're thinking about either messaging and this framework. It's the outcome for most people is to book more meetings, drive more pipeline, get responses from your prospects, right? That's the outcome. And the four levers from my perspective that drive that from a BDR perspective are messaging, activities, targeting, and time.
Yeah. Which is a great way of thinking through like the probabilities. And if you're studying, like you said, this isn't prescriptive. You're studying what is working and then working your way backwards based on like, how do I forever increase those probabilities?
Yeah, that's right. That's what you're placing your bets, if you will, in these different areas, right? Because you can always work on your messaging, but is that going to be more effective than making sure your targeting is correct and actually going after the right personas, right? So which one do you focus on?
I even like the idea of thinking about the targeting piece, because there's so many different ways in which you can target anyone you decide to reach out to. Mm-hmm. I happen to favor targeting that has some form of lead prioritization baked in. And lead prioritization, I think, can come from the prospect and their actions or their company's actions being superior to just a name on a list that was relevant to me. Whether I'm working off of a geo or alphabetical or some other highly strategic method. I'm joking there, because I don't think that the latter are too strategic whatsoever.
Yeah, it's an interesting point. I had a conversation with a marketer recently who told me that lead scoring was BS. And I had a tendency to agree with that because if you try to put it into a numeric sense and against this amalgamation of different things that they do, how do you truly know what is more valuable than others? And the most advanced marketing teams would have some sort of attribution software that they use to take a look at the probability of this action driving a specific outcome. But without that level of finesse, which most organizations, I would argue, probably don't have until they have really advanced marketing analytics and marketing ops, it's just a kind of a guess, right? And I think what I liked about what you said is it's prioritization, right? It's just all relative. It's what is the likelihood that what they did is more related to the fact that they're potentially interested or would even just pick up the phone and talk to us or respond. And naturally, you want to put your efforts against the people that probabilistically will respond to you first than the ones that won't. So it makes a lot of sense. And I'm going to read that book because this is the, I don't know, third time or fourth time someone's mentioned it to me in the last couple of months. So I'll get back on it and maybe we can even do a follow-up
I love
or a
it. I
chat.
love it. That would be fun. And I recommend it for all the listeners too, because I just think that Annie's had a number of books out. They're really well written, but it's just a good way of, I almost view it, I file it under the heading of teaching people how to think, therefore valuable.
100%.
One of the things that, while we're on the subject of lead prioritization, that's interesting to me, starts with the marketing. And I definitely think this is a marketing lens, but I'd love to gauge your kind of like temperature on how you think of it as a sales development leader. When I think of lead prioritization, I think first and foremost about buyer's journey. So I have an ideal customer profile, and it's however big or whatever criteria goes into that. And that's me as a vendor, as a leader, my targeting strategy. But then I want to always be able to graft onto that, not just my purview of the world, but what are my buyers doing? What are my buyers like? Where do they go on their journey? And how might I spot them when they do, like when their triggers, when they hit certain buying triggers that might make them ultra relevant to me for outreach? A few of the bigger buckets that we like to talk about over here at Science are inbound led outbound, when we can identify buyers that might be on our website, like potentially researching us as a company, but not taking a commit action as a marketer might experience. Another big bucket might be intent. So intent could be expressed in a lot of different ways. There's tools that can identify intent, but they can also be just kind of normal triggers. I would think of, if you're ever running funding campaigns, hiring campaigns, those types of intent triggers as being super relevant. But those two buckets being very much above and beyond any kind of list-led outbound going forward.
It's really interesting because maybe we're skipping ahead here. That's what the last T, the timing, is really about. And when you think about all of this, there's even before I go into it, it really depends on your overall go-to-market strategy. So there's a term here that people may be familiar with called the double funnel. So you ask about what does it look like from a sales development perspective. If you apply this double funnel methodology, what you're describing sounds a little bit more demand gen oriented, where it's engagement of different records, and we prioritize our outreach based on accounts that are potentially in the market or those that we've identified in the market. We use, to your point, engagement on the website or with us directly, as well as intent to help lead those efforts. Makes a lot of sense. I think a lot of organizations do this, and it works well enough because it's again this opportunity for them to prioritize their efforts and hopefully invest their time and energies into a more warm bucket, so to speak. The other part of it, though, and where the sales development side comes in, is that the role of sales development is about proactively getting into the accounts that we want as a business, right? So it's much more of a more akin to an account-based mindset where, hey, like we know that we have this top 100 or there's a certain number of accounts that we need to get into because we believe that it's going to be a game changer for the business, right? Drive higher ACV, et cetera. And those are times where, from an outbound perspective, in spite of the fact that we may have folks engage, but it's not really within the focus of the smaller subset of accounts that we want to go after, we would still go after those accounts because they're critical to the business. And the hope here is naturally that the efforts of marketing, sales development align to somehow direct that engagement and the like to those businesses. But it goes back to this nature of cold outbound sales, so to speak, where you go after the right personas based on what we've established or good fits, which is the targeting piece, and going after them and hoping that through our attempts at interaction, it drives them toward the website. It builds, it's like this fire approach, right? Where you have one bush that's on fire and then it just becomes a whole fireball, an inferno of sorts.
Yeah, for sure. Because none of these things are mutually exclusive. In fact, I would even argue that like the more, I think HubSpot has this term and they've been trying to popularize it for a while, but they call it the flywheel. And that's the way that they view sales, as getting it spinning with all of your different channels, like interacting naturally together with one another.
100%. Yep.
Which, if you have to have a metaphor, that seems like the right one, given the fact that most buyers' journeys are not linear. They're very idiosyncratic. They're very all over the place. I'll even steal the phrase that you used earlier. They're very ad hoc.
Yeah, 100%. 100%.
So in thinking about that, I'd love to actually focus again a little bit on the maybe the diagnostic, but maybe the management of such. Because if you think about like the activities, so the A in Matt, and organizing one's activities around kind of account-based principles, around the triggers or inbound slash intent slash whatever type of outbound you want to do.
Right.
How do you like to think about organizing those activities down to the SDR level for maximum success on a day-to-day basis?
I love that question because you're a bit leading the witness there, right? I think a lot of it comes from having a really disciplined sales development organization where there's expectations that are set and as a benchmark even, and seeing whether or not people perform against that. I think some organizations, it was very in vogue in the early 2010s where leaders would go, just do whatever you want. And we have no activity requirements. And all the BDRs that are interviewing are so excited because it came from an organization that had them make 40, 50 calls, which honestly isn't even that much, to be quite honest, every day to do that. And people were sick of it. And they wanted to just use new channels like LinkedIn at the time, and their reps that hit their number on just emails and just LinkedIn, et cetera. And they just want to do that. And that doesn't really work because you can't scale it out. So you need a system, right? And again, it's this idea of thinking of bets. That's why we go for a multi-channel approach, right? You have your calls, you have your videos, you have your LinkedIns. In the UK, you have your WhatsApp, you have emails, all this good stuff to help think through, okay, I'm going to get one meeting from email this month, but I'll get three from calls. I have one from LinkedIn. And in this composite view, hit my number. Your question was really around, okay, how do you actually ensure that you're getting the right set of, from a management perspective, actually getting the right results, right? And I think the one thing to think about this from a management perspective is, what is the overall yield from the activities that you're taking a look at? So as a rep, you'd be thinking, okay, I need to make X number of calls. I do the backwards math. I'm sure there's a lot of great spreadsheets out there to tell you how much you need to do. But as a manager, you're thinking about, how do you get the activities on the right accounts? So I'll give you an example. Three companies ago, was in an employee engagement software company called Waggle, very small one. And we focused on selling pulse surveys and employee engagement surveys, which at the time was a really new concept. And what we found was that if there was a director of employee engagement, we should talk to them. We would have thunk, right? And everyone else around that was relevant, but not as relevant.
Yeah.
So then you think about it, and obviously there's a targeting piece here, but it's okay, if all a BDR does all day is literally just make X number of dials, activities, outreach attempts toward this, probabilistically, there's a higher chance that we'll actually drive toward a successful outcome, right? When I think about it from a manager's perspective, and this is related to the next T targeting, all of this obviously is very much aligned, it's thinking through, okay, are we placing our bets on too much of one channel? Are we single prompt,
right?
Are we just calling? Are we just emailing? Are we putting our activities against one persona, right? Or one industry, and how we work with our targeting, which we'll get into in a second, right? Is the content of our message too short, too long, right? Again, what is the channel that it's being delivered on, right? Yeah. Am I doing too much or too little, right? And then it's the quality of that activity. So for instance, it's, are we just, you can say something as simple as we're dialing, we're making X number of dials, right? But what does that actually mean? Am I dialing cell phones? Am I dialing and leaving a voicemail? Am I dialing at the right time? Maybe I do a double tap. Maybe I'm calling them at the right time. Like, there's so much more to it when you actually take a look. And I think the point of this is actually taking a look at how you're doing it beyond just the check mark, right? It's not just looking at open rates. It's looking at the actual emails. How are you inspecting and building a process, which is your question, around doing all those things and having those clear expectations? So to give you a very long-winded but direct answer to your questions of how management actually enables that, it's having really clear expectations of what and how much they need to do, where, right? It's having a very clear sense from a managerial perspective on how you inspect that and making sure that people are actually doing what they're supposed to be doing. And it's never going to be perfect, right? But at least there's a baseline and you do allow for some deviation, right? That's people's natural creativity. You have folks that are just going to kill it and that's great. But it all goes back to what is the yield of the activities that we're doing from an efficiency perspective. And you look at it from something as basic as what's the total number of activities that we do to the number of opportunities that we generate, for instance, right? Like things like that is how we should be thinking about it. And how do we build programs to support all of these things?
I love that. I love that. And that is such a perfect answer because my mind just goes immediately to one of the trickiest channels that I've seen for people to make work. And that's the phone channel. Obviously, you already addressed call reluctance syndrome a little bit earlier. But there's a million articles. Just go to Google and type this cold calling dead and watch the results fly. And yet, like some of whether cold calling works or not comes back to these just very stupid, simple basics. Like, when is your call block? If most of your prospects are, if you are working in the East Coast and most of your prospects are on the West Coast, here's a funny thing from a five-time CMO that I'll share with you who happens to be a lifelong Californian. Vast majority of my meetings or open blocks in my schedule are from 3 o'clock Pacific on.
Yeah. Sure. 100%.
And I will never, ever pick up a cold call before 8 a.m. Pacific, aka 11 a.m. Eastern time. So if you're working in that time zone, like you've got a natural mismatch to your prospects just around how the equipment is. And again, those stupid, simple basics.
It's really interesting that you bring that up. So I have two thoughts for you. One, I don't think call reluctance is much of a thing anymore, which sounds surprising, but over the last, I want to say 2 or 3 years, we're seeing the reemergence of cold calling and in the SDR leadership community, it's becoming actually the dominant channel again. And part of that is because I don't want to perpetuate this too much, but cold emails don't work now. It's this weird cycle, right? Like it was not cold calling didn't work for a while because everyone was doing it. Now everyone's doing emails. Okay, so we're back to cold calling. And we have more, the power dialers are really popular again, right? There's like a parallel dialer or whatever, as people call it. And I won't mention the name here, I'm sure.
Yeah. But there's too much power in a lot of those too.
Yes, exactly. So that's coming back. But I think the point that I'm hearing from you, which I want to reiterate, it's around being thoughtful and strategic around how you execute against those activities on those channels. And it's this, again, thoughtfulness, which is the intent of this framework, which is the way in which we're thinking about management, that people just have a tendency to overlook because from a sales development leadership perspective, there's just so much dogma. There's just all these old beliefs of this is just what you do, right? And we just do it and we just accept it. No, because sales development leadership is one of the most innovative and fast changing industries in the go-to-market chain.
Right?
Every year has been really different by macroeconomic factors, by compliance related issues, but like GDPR, which we don't talk about anymore, was in 2019 June.
Yeah.
And that's 5 years ago. Wow. But you know what I'm saying? There's just so much that's going on and we just need to continually innovate. And a lot of things that we've held as principles or this is how you do it, you need to put it into the closet for a bit and pull it out when the next time comes.
Yeah. So I'm curious, what other dogmas do you think people are slaves to? Maybe even without even realizing it, habit and inertia are two powerful things in companies.
Yeah, no, that's a good question. That's a really good question. I think there's the old young and hungry BDRs, right? So folks that are straight out of college and the perspective of running athletes and stuff. That's a really big one. There's a whole one about just put your head down and dial and just do a ton of activities. And statistically, it will probably help you. But there's also a lot of externalities that we don't think about. So I think this is the one that kind of scares me, because as an SDR leader, you're managing the overall life cycle of that SDR program. So what I mean about that is, if you're an SDR leader and you joined another org where you took over a team, or there was a predecessor there and you're not building this from scratch, the first thing you go to do most likely is you do your audit of their technologies, right? It's okay, what sequences or cadences do they have? Is their email server completely in the trash can?
Right?
How many unsubscribes do we have against our target personas? That's your hygiene. And what you come to realize is, like, sales development, it's like scorched earth, right? Yes. It's you're a new BDR. Forget it. Let's just go. Just call everyone. Doesn't matter if they say no. Doesn't matter if you call their cell phone. Just go. Just call. Right. And sure, one person, one rep, two maybe, right? A small handful of the early reps get to reap the benefits of that. And then a half a year later, you have new BDRs that come in and go, wait a second. Every C-suite against my target accounts, they've all opted out. What do I do? So it's just being very thoughtful about your activities so that you don't hose yourself into the future, because people have this short-term mindset of going about it. And it's just this thing where it's like this scorched earth training ground, whatever. And then you just pluck your BDR to become an AE, and then the new BDRs have to figure it out. The new manager figures it out, et cetera. So I think those are the things that come to me immediately. Yeah, I think those are the two big ones. I'm sure there's a lot, there's a ton, but.
Really salient points though. And it's funny that there's two seemingly oxymoronic or opposite ideas that came to mind as you were describing that. And that is, like, it's a clear mistake that I see happening all the time when new, like you said, scorched earth, raw, young and hungry SDRs are dialing into your tier one accounts, yeah. Right? Because on one hand, you never get a second chance to make a first impression. If that impression is bad,
yeah.
Yeah. On the other hand, I also happen to be a believer, and this is the oxymoronic part. I don't remember who emailed me or called me last week, let alone 3 months ago.
Sure. Yeah.
You know what I mean? Even if it was the most brutal outreach of all time.
Yeah.
So there's this kind of like weird dualism around doing a job versus just doing the job. And then
hold on, Eric. Wait. So you're saying as a 6-time CMO, it's okay for us to just completely ignore a prospect's opt-out request?
I'm not saying that. I'm not saying that.
Yeah.
But I'm saying most people, especially if it's a bad cold call, aren't going to remember that beyond, unless it was so bad that it was memorable enough to somehow recount later on down the line.
Yeah. I would tend to agree with you there. But I think what I said a bit tongue-in-cheek is, at a certain point, someone's going to do such a bad job that they opt out.
Yeah.
Someone's going to do such a bad job that they go and indeed make them remember. So again, the point isn't that we don't let new BDRs call. We shouldn't. Bear with me for a second here. Is that we adequately prepare the BDRs for those conversations and we help them prioritize, right? Everything that we've been talking about, to get them ready to the point where they have the highest probability of success. And I think it's, again, it's the thoughtful management around all of that. Right? It's this lack of scorched earth of, like, why is it that a BDR would naturally choose the, you know, most perfect fit persona? Well, it's because we coach them to do that. But at the same time, have we coached them enough that they can do that well? And the quality of this, going back to our activities, really matter. Are they ready to have that sort of conversation?
Yeah, really well said. Because I think that it's like everything in life. There's a sequencing, there's a training, there's a readiness, a poise, if you will, building up to those moments that matter.
100%. 100%.
Yeah. So at any rate, pretty fascinating study of how we build out like SDR operations and the criteria and the considerations that go into doing all of that. Mm-hmm. Last kind of bit that I'd love to focus on with the MAT model is really around where we stand. And I think that the vast majority of tech tools are still around the targeting piece.
Sure.
That we have access to, or that we use, or that we obsess over, or that we curse in the dark because they suck. Give me your thoughts on like targeting done well. Go ahead.
Oh, no, please finish your thought.
I was just going to say, as a savvy SDR leader, when you think about targeting and you think about being on top of your game, what is your like overall thoughts and strategies along those lines?
I think at a really high level, this is not going to be particularly new to anyone. And if you have, you know, if as a listener, you've bared with us for the last 40 minutes or so, it's being very thoughtful about it. And that targeting piece is in two parts. The first is naturally the companies you go after and why. And then the second is obviously the people, right? Because we're selling to people, they'll work at companies and understanding that they're not one and the same, right? Personas aren't people, personas are personas, right? It's like this big circle and gets smaller and smaller. On that point, I'm going to separate the two and I'll talk about both. So I'll start with the company first. Company and ICP fit, it's all the same thing, right? Naturally, your business will have different use cases that resonate with different companies. Maybe there are specific industries that you serve. Maybe there's characteristics around different companies that will say that this is going to be a good fit depending on the stage of organization that you're at. If you are at an earlier stage company, you as the BDR leader probably are tasked with finding some of this, right? Mm-hmm. But if you work at a mid or late stage, perhaps your RevOps team, sales ops team would have already identified your ICPs, bought like a data provider to help you and give you an actual list of accounts.
Yep.
Right, in a named account model or even a territory where they have guidance for you. And from a BDR perspective, an IC perspective is, let's say that you have a list of accounts, right? You've identified that there's a couple hundred, maybe you were just given these accounts. How do you go after the right ones in your territory?
Yeah.
What are those indicators that tell you that they're a good fit, right? Relative to all the other ones that are supposed to fit. And a lot of that is related to the next T of timing of what is their engagement looking like with your website? Are they showing intent, right? Again, this is really timing related. Do we have a lot of recent customers buy because of something that happened? Again, timing related. Is it because we have a lot of materials, customer stories, et cetera, to tell us that this is a salient focus for us, right? And then obviously whether or not we have support for marketing against different activities. Maybe it's like we have field marketing events in this, you know, in this geo, something like that, right? And that's the company fit, right? And we build programs around how do we just prioritize the right set of companies. Within those companies though, you have the people, right? So how do you understand who are the right people to go after? And there's a tops-down, bottoms-up strategy that everyone knows, of course, and you can build programs to go after these people. But the other part of it is thinking through, okay, what do you do with everyone else? How do you think about building plays for perhaps non-fit personas that can yield a specific outcome for you? And what's your focus there? Is it building cadences for that? Is it more automated messaging? Is it having something where you can use to gather information from an account-based model? If you're taking a more demand gen-esque approach, you just want to go after your perfect fit personas or people in your buying group, and that's probably it. Maybe you get some more information. Some of the things to think about from a targeting perspective is going after the right titles, right level. Are you going after enough people? And it's usually one of those three things at a high level that will dictate your success outside of obviously the activities, your messaging, and your timing.
How do you like to think about buying group representation? And even role plays, because we're not starting sales conversations as an academic exercise. At the end of the day, the ultimate goal is close one net new business.
Yes.
And obviously sales is going to have a million and one opinions about the best fit personas. Sure. Not all of them are going to be right. One of the things I always look with a very almost cynical eye, because they salespeople are oftentimes governed by recency bias or primacy bias. Whatever they came into a situation thinking would be the best buyer and whatever they last deal they closed, mm-hmm. really shaping their opinion, which can lead to a lot of trouble.
Sure. Perhaps. So it depends on the maturity model of your business overall. So if you're like at a public tech company, you probably know what your buyers are unless you sell in a use case based model, right? If you're at a mid-stage startup, there's probably enough TAM out there for you to just repeat a specific type of deal and you have clarity on who you're going after for now, right? Yep. And then if you're super early stage, that's where it gets a little bit murky because you have to identify the use case, the product market fit, assuming you have that, and then subsequently backtracking deals to figure out how you actually made it happen, right? And typically the idea is that people go after, okay, there's certain verticals or certain titles, types of titles that we go after, and we try to replicate that business based on what it is that we offer. At a high level, that's how most people would do it. I think if one were to be a detective and want to like really understand that and go through this process themselves, it's backtracking actual deals closed won, right? Yes. Over an X period of time, taking a look at if you have good Salesforce hygiene, who the primary first point of contact is and how that deal developed, what are the titles that, you know, inevitably come out and what their role is. And that's a level of ops skill that most BDR managers on their own probably would not have yet, but they can absolutely develop there. Maybe they work with their sales ops partners, because if you sell tech at some point, security is going to be a part of it.
Yeah.
Not because they're a buyer, because they're going to go through a security review. It's going to be a part of it. Why? Because you're selling technology. No, of course. But then it's thinking about, okay, who are the users of the product over the end users of the product, who their managers are, who makes those decisions, right? Is it within a certain department? Is it a specific title? If you have a very solid process, like you go with a Medpic-based approach and you actually identify champions, are there consistent trends among the types of champions that you have and you test for them? Things like that to help you. But again, it's really dependent on your business maturity overall, because I would imagine that a lot of this exists in the upside of the house already, one would hope. And if you're earlier stage, it's a fight for product market fit, use case fit, et cetera, which you then have to go through the diligence of looking for patterns. And
looking for patterns is so important too, because to me, the framework butts up against one of the biggest trends, I think, of our time, which is consensus buying, which is real. And only more so in times of economic pullback or recession, where nobody wants to make an autocratic decision, stand out on an island and spend a company's money that I've observed in a buying group, like ever. People love to buy, but they hate to be sold. And most buying processes, unless you're at an enterprise organization with a formalized procurement department, again, happens very ad hoc.
Yep.
Happens very all over the place.
Idea of consensus buying is really interesting. I can give you an example on the flip side of that, of consensus retainment of products as well.
Yeah.
So at my current company, we were, like most organizations, contracted with a leading signature provider, right? And we churned from this leading signature provider because our head of legal was tasked with reducing costs. And unilaterally, this person, from my perspective, made a decision to go with a more emergent signature solution, which did not draw the support of everyone that uses a signature product outside of their specific team. So it's interesting, right? Because autonomous decisions, even on the flip side of making a decision to go elsewhere, is not very good, but that decision was made by the person that, I guess, owned the software. And it has negative repercussions for other people. So this idea of forming consensus is especially important on the buyer side, because you don't want to create enemies, for the lack of better words, within the organization that you're selling to.
And I think of it as very emotional too. Most people don't want to acknowledge just how emotional B2B buying is. Like, that person will forever be known to you and others in the organization as the guy or gal that changed this.
Yes.
For the worse.
Yes, 100%. That's right.
And so just part of the social fabric of companies and the environment that we operate in. Oh my gosh, we have touched on so many different topics and all in a kind of a wonderfully diverse conversation. Jimmy, for anyone else in the audience that may want to continue this conversation with you, pick your brain a little bit more about the framework, how you do what you do over there at Envoy, where should they go?
Feel free to hit me up on LinkedIn. My LinkedIn is just my name, Jimmy Chen, from Envoy, which is the organization that I'm with today. Very easy to find. If you want to email me, absolutely, we can share that with you afterwards. But yeah, I'm always open to contributing to the greater sales development space, whether you're a rep or a manager, a rep interested in management and the like. I'm happy to help.
That's awesome. Really appreciate it. And I really appreciated this conversation. It was a lot of fun.
Likewise. Thank you so much, Eric.
You betcha.